Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This Friday is a special day. Yes, it marks the end of the Mayan calendar, but it's also the 75th anniversary, the beginning of the golden age of animation, with the debut of Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It's hard today to understand how groundbreaking this film was back in 1937, technically, artistically, and in animated storytelling. Well, my guest today fully tells the story of the making of this film and separates the fact from fiction. For example, Walt Disney did nearly gamble everything on the success of the film, but unlike popular lore, studio heads and critics were not predicting failure. In fact, the debut of the film was Hollywood's biggest event in 1937. J.B. Kaufman is an author and film historian at the Walt Disney Family Foundation, has written extensively on both Disney animation as well as American silent film. His new book, The Fairest One of All, The Making of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, is a beautiful book with cells from the motion picture, numerous sketches, and traces every part of the story in both text and illustration. J.B. Kaufman is my guest today. J.B. Kaufman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich. It's good to be with you.
This is the 75th anniversary of the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the first full-length animated film. Today we think of this as a major cultural icon. What I was surprised to learn, I've always, you know, there's a whole, I guess, a whole myth about the creation of this film, one of which was that everybody expected Walt Disney to fail. And from what I gather in the book, you didn't find that. In fact, it was like one of the biggest celebrated film events of the year going into the very first showing.
Yeah, it really was. It's, you know, the story that you always hear is that it was referred to in Hollywood as Disney's folly. In fact, I never saw any references to that in the press until after the film had opened, when people were using it to demonstrate how wrong the critics had been. But in fact, the trade press and the general press were already very much taken with Walt Disney and the great short cartoons that he had made. And the general feeling seemed to be that whatever this man took on, he would do something really wonderful and original with it. So I think people went into it expecting something kind of wonderful.
Well, given that, how big of a leap was it to produce a first full-length animated film?
Well, it was a considerable leap, and it went beyond just the sheer running time of the film. Because, I mean, it would have been one thing to make a 10-reel Mickey Mouse. But clearly, you know, Walt was thinking way, way outside of that box. And he knew that this would have to be something that was different from anything that had ever been seen before. The idea was that you would produce a feature-length film that would be the centerpiece of the program. It would be a full evening's entertainment, but it would be produced with this wonderful medium of animation, which he and his artists had done so much to develop to a new level during the 1930s.
And that's interesting. You know, you said this was the centerpiece of the evening, and we have to remember that film was seen very differently in the 1930s than it is today. You know, there was newsreels, there were short features, there were usually cartoons, and then the feature. Was it shown pretty much like that in the 1930s and early 40s?
Yeah, it was shown with a full program. I think most theaters felt that they didn't need to provide an animated cartoon with Snow White, but yeah, that would have been the normal thing. This was at a time when the movie industry was a really viable and healthy industry, and American films really were at their peak at this time. So one of the things that went with that was a full level of showmanship. And yeah, when you went to the theater, you expected a full evening's entertainment with all of the extras.
In fact, in the big cities like Los Angeles and New York, I mean, if a big film was opening, you might have displays outside the theater. You would have, and in fact, it sounds like it was like a full-scale parade.
It really was
Snow White.
Yeah, it really was. They were major events. And when a movie was eagerly anticipated, then there was a lot of reflection of that in the press and just in the culture in general.
Now take us back to how Walt Disney got the idea of doing Snow White and of doing the full length feature. Now he'd had big success in 1933 with the Three Little Pigs, mm-hmm. and. This, I guess, was a big hit, even though it was still a short.
That's right. He, Mickey Mouse had made his debut at the very end of 1928, and going into the early 30s, he was kind of slowly becoming a worldwide phenomenon, and Walt followed up on that with the Silly Symphonies, which was a separate series of cartoons. And these were such delightful and charming and original animated cartoons that they really got people's attention. And so Walt was starting to become a household name. And he had come up with so many innovations that it was only a matter of time before he burst the bounds of one-reel cartoons and went to something very different and something longer and more substantial. As far as the story of Snow White, he had seen the silent Paramount Pictures version of Snow White in 1916 when he was a kid in Kansas City. And he and the showing made a big impression on him. And he also started thinking about the story, and he told people that he thought it was just the perfect story because it had the sympathetic characters, it had the dwarfs, which were a natural for comic relief and were natural vehicles for animation. And he just thought, from every angle, it was the perfect story for his first feature.
And as you begin the book, you remind us that there's not one Snow White tale. There's probably half dozen, maybe even as many as a dozen Snow White stories. And really, that Paramount of silent film was a big part of the film, although he took elements from a variety of the Snow White stories.
Yeah, I was surprised to find, you see, I started with the film. the movies are kind of my window into everything else. But I thought it would be interesting to find out more about the context of the story, and I wound up getting a crash course in the history of folklore, because this story of Snow White goes back to an oral tradition that goes back hundreds of years. It really originated hundreds of years before the Brothers Grimm published their version. So yeah, there was already kind of this widespread cultural phenomenon of this story, which touched such a primal chord for so many people.
But it's a big part of it, that 1916 silent film, that seems to be one of the main influences on this. But what was the reaction when he brought it to his animators? Were the animators just feeling their oats at the point where they said, yes, we can do this? Or was there resistance from the animators at first?
Well, there was a little of both, actually, because it's true. It was the 1930s were a tremendously exciting time at the Disney studio, and they really knew. They had redefined the art of animation, and everybody else in the animation business knew it, and they were really proud of what they were accomplishing. On the other hand, this was a pretty daunting thing to undertake. It was such a difficult job to produce one reel of animated cartoons that to do a complete feature was something that set some of the artists back a little bit. But in the end, one of the things that you always hear when there aren't that many people around anymore who worked with Walt Disney, but while there were, I talked to a number of them. And one thing that you would always hear was that Walt was so inspiring to work with that he could bring things out of people that they didn't know they could do.
And this is what is interesting, is we think of Walt Disney as being the early animator, and of course he does give over all the animation to other people, but he's like a symphony conductor in many senses. The way he directed the putting together of this film, he was constantly editing and editing and editing, whether it be animations or the story or even the backgrounds.
Right. See, animation is probably the most micromanaged form of art ever. And Walt was all over this film. He was immersed in every detail of it. As you say, he hadn't done any actual animation for over 10 years by the time he got started on Snow White. But we think of him as an artist more in a class with the other great filmmakers of the time, the D.W. Griffiths and the John Fords and the Frank Capras, whose vision was the important thing. And they would exercise their talents to bring together all of the other subordinate talents to create this film that carried out that vision.
And it's interesting, the story and the characters, it took them a long time to actually get this all together. I mean, it didn't come together as a script from the start. I mean, this was a pretty long process.
That's right. It took about 4 years altogether to produce the film. And you're right. One of the things that I found really striking going into the research for this book was that there was a tremendous range of creative ideas that they started with and that they were willing to consider. I don't think they ruled anything out to start with. They had this tremendous, unlimited palette of ideas to choose from. And it's pretty surprising when you see some of the ones that they considered and then eventually ruled out.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at the cover picture of the book, and you can almost see the amalgam of animators' work, because the dwarfs have a certain look. Snow White has a certain look. The Queen has a certain look. The witch has a certain look. The prince and the huntsman, they all have their own looks. And as you go through the book and you see the various competing elements sort of vying for the look of the character, you can see why that turns out to be the case.
yeah, it really is. It's you know, the thing, people ask me about, you know, the element of Disney magic in Snow White, and I tell them that it had a lot less to do with magic than it did with just plain hard work. And a big part of that was the character development with any one of the characters. And I think people get kind of a kick out of seeing some of the dwarfs that were considered and then not used.
Yes.
But there was always a reason for that. You know, they had some really wonderful creative ideas, which in the end they decided were not right for this film. So nothing you see in the film is there by accident. You know, they really, really carefully refined and analyzed and reworked the character development and everything else about the film.
In fact, there are two models for Snow White, too, aren't there?
That's right. There were two animators who were principally responsible for animating Snow White. And when you look at their work, it's clear that one of them leans more toward her as a wide-eyed, innocent young girl, and the other tends to portray her more as a more mature young woman, which actually kind of encapsulates the two poles of the character in traditional versions of the story. But once you start to see that, you get to a point where whenever you watch the film, every time Snow White comes onto the screen, you can instantly see that she is one or the other version of that character.
In fact, in most versions of the story, Snow White is like a very young girl, like 7 or 8. And then by the end of the tale, she's marrying the prince.
That's right. And in fact, in the Brothers Grimm, she is explicitly 7 years old at the beginning of the story. And they don't tell you how much time goes by during the course of the story, but it doesn't seem like that much. And at the end, she marries the prince. And this was something that you could get away with in a written story or spoken story. And in fact, a lot of folklorists believe that those numbers weren't meant to be taken as literal numbers, but as symbolic expressions. But they become a little more problematic when you're actually picturing the character on stage or on screen. And I think that the way they handled it in the Disney film is a brilliant way of kind of resolving that tension.
And of course, the voice of Snow White is that high-pitched voice. And it's interesting that they actually had actresses coming in to model Snow White. And in the case of the voice, that's probably one of the biggest criticisms, that very high-pitched singing voice of Snow White. But Walt felt that was absolutely critical. It goes back to that idea of being the wide-eyed innocent.
That's right. It is the case. I personally don't have a problem with Snow White's voice, but I think that in the world at large, even people who love the film very often have a distaste for Snow White's voice. But again, Walt, you know, didn't do anything by accident. I think he knew exactly the kind of voice he was looking for. And in fact, when he was auditioning voices, he made a point of having the applicant sing or speak into a mic that was on the studio soundstage, and he wouldn't be there. He'd be in his office listening to the voice over a speaker because he didn't want to be influenced by the girl's appearance.
Well, interesting. And not right. Right. Exactly. That's what we want. Exactly. But that's kind of funny. My guest today is J.B. Kaufman, film historian of the Walt Disney Family Foundation, a specialist on Disney animation as well as American silent film. His new book celebrates the 75th anniversary of the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which still entertains young kids introduced to the beautiful animation of Disney, classic animation of Disney. The name of the book is The Fairest One of All, The Making of Walt Disney Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you mentioned the discarded dwarfs. That was interesting to me. And, of course, this book is filled with animation cells. You see a lot of sketches, a lot of character composites, some of which were discarded, some which became the basis for the character. And one of the most interesting things is all the number of dwarfs that went through the cut to become part of the Seven. And some were, by today's standards, pretty politically incorrect.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say
that. It's stubby, which had a peg leg, and the physical maladies. And rightly, I think Disney said that was probably not right. That's sort of prescient, in a sense.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no doubt. He was well ahead of his time, and in some ways, he still is ahead of his time. But, yeah, it was the idea of making each dwarf a personality type or a trait, and then naming them after that trait, was part of the plan from the beginning. But it was also known that there would only be 7 dwarfs, and overall there were something more than 50 applicants for those 7 jobs. So, yeah, some of the choices that they decided not to use are pretty interesting today. I think one of my favorites is Awful, who was the description was he steals and drinks and is very dirty. And so he became kind of the scapegoat. While he was part of the lineup, he became the scapegoat of the dwarfs, so that whenever anything went wrong, he would be blamed for it, whether it was actually his fault or not. And his attitude was always kind of cheerful acceptance. Well, I deserve it. There was another one, which, as you say, would probably have a little trouble getting by today. There was one named Deafy, who was deaf, and who actually hung on longer than most of the others. He was still part of the group as late as January of 1936. And I think partly the reason that he was phased out may have been that they got some comedy out of him, but he also slowed down the story, because every time anything happened, the other dwarfs would have to explain it to Deafy, and usually more than once.
Right, right. Yeah, no, that was sort of a comic relief character, and again, I guess Dopey reflected that. And it's interesting that you said Harpo Marx was obviously an influence for Dopey.
He was. And in fact, there were several of the classic comedians who were influences on Dopey. There was a silent comedian named Harry Langdon. I don't know whether you're familiar with him, but he was very popular for a very short time in the 1920s. And he had the character of, he was an adult, he lived in the adult world, but his mannerisms were those of a very small child. And, you know, not everybody thinks that's exactly tasteful today, but he was very popular for a while. And Walt specifically referred to Langdon more than once in story conferences. Stan Laurel was another influence, and yeah, you're right, Harpo Marx was yet a third. And it's interesting that Harpo Marx, after the film was released, he claimed that he'd been back to see it several times over and over.
Now, it's interesting, in today's animation, when we see especially a well-known actor portraying a animated character, you can see the animators putting a bit of that character. I'm thinking of like Aladdin, the genie, with you know, Robin Williams, or some of the other characters. You can see a little bit of that actor's personality showing up in the animation. The same was true back in 1936 and 37 when they had these voice actors coming in to do, well, the character that did the actor who did Doc, for example, when he would misspeak, he would do a little bit of physical business that became incorporated into the animation. It's interesting that these traditions go back all the way to the beginning.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's one of the great strengths of the film, is that you have really altogether, you've got something like a half century of American popular culture embedded in the film. Already, just in the voices of the characters, because you're right, Roy Atwell, who did the voice of Doc, he was a radio comic who did that kind of, you know, spoonerisms and mixed up words as part of his routine, and a number of his mannerisms were incorporated into the character. Same thing with Otis Harlan, who did the voice of Happy, one of the top dwarf animators. Said that he spent some time with Harlan and just watched his mannerisms and then incorporated those into Happy. So you really, in a sense, you have the talents of this long line of American popular performers embedded in the film in the form of those performances.
Yeah, and they're just unknown to us today. I guess that's the difference. But another interesting choice was, you know, animation was very much big on animals and talking animals. And, of course, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs do have animals in the film that act not like animals. But an interesting decision was a very big edict in the film was no talking animals.
That's right. That's right. See, each one of these films exists on a different kind of plane of fantasy. And this was, Snow White was never intended to be a realistic film, but it was intended to have a kind of fantasy that was deeply rooted in reality, so that when you watch the animals moving, you would recognize traces of the actual creature, and it would just make the fantasy that much more convincing. For example, the deer in Snow White are far less realistic than the ones that they did just a few years later in Bambi, which were animated by the same artists. And again, that's not an accident. That's exactly the way Walt pictured this, because that was the kind of fantasy it was. They they suggested the real thing, but they didn't. They still looked like cartoon deer.
We've talked about the animators and the development of the character, but the other part of the movie that, of course, the new classic Disney animation is also mimicked is the art of getting great songs as a part of the score. And in this case, it was the music of Frank Churchill. And we tend to overlook this when we think of the film. We think of the look of the film, but not the sound of the film.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up because you're right. Churchill was a great, great composer. And he had actually put the Disney studio on the popular music map when he wrote Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf for Three Little Pigs, which actually, believe it or not, had been a big hit song in 1933. A lot of people saw it as a reaction to the Depression, you know, that old expression of having the wolf at your door.
Right.
So he had had, and he had done others too, but those would kind of fall into the category of novelty songs. And there were novelty songs in Snow White, including most of the ones that the dwarfs sing. But there were also songs like Someday My Prince Will Come, which became a standard contribution to the American popular music songbook. And Churchill, he was a pretty interesting guy. He was a real happy-go-lucky character, but he also had a dark side. And it turned out that he could come up with these melodies seemingly out of thin air that were just really classic, enduring melodies.
One of the interesting things is, of course, as this full-length animated film comes to life, there's too much film, and there have to be cuts. And I guess you have had a chance to see the deleted scenes, and apparently there were some really good scenes that were cut just for length.
That's right. That's right. And that's an example of this uncanny ability that Walt had as a story editor to keep his eye on details, but also never lose sight of the big picture. The most famous example of that is what's called the soup sequence. Originally, when Snow White called the dwarfs in for supper, they were going to come stampeding into the house and dive into this meal of soup that she had prepared and slurp it and basically eat like animals until she tried to teach them table manners. And her lessons weren't entirely successful, but it was a really entertaining and really funny sequence, and it was being animated. It was to the point of animation when Walt decided that the film was running too long, and that was a point where he needed to keep the story moving instead of slowing it down. So he made the very difficult decision to cut it out. Again, it's been cited many times since then as an example of his overall vision, saying that yes, this is great in itself, but it doesn't make a contribution to the overall film, and we need to take it out.
Now, at the beginning of our conversation, we talked about the myth surrounding Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. What I gather is a true story is that this was a major gamble for Walt Disney. If it had not come out well, we probably wouldn't be talking about the Disney studio. Did he really sink everything into this film?
He really did. And I would never bet against Walt Disney. I think one way or another, he would have found some way to keep going. But you're right, the studio as it existed then, that might have been the end of the story if Snow White had failed, because he had borrowed money. He had to extend his loan with the bank over and over. He had gambled his life insurance and his mortgage. He was in it for everything, and so it was in that sense it was a tremendous gamble. But for him, it was less of a gamble because he had faith in it. I think that he always felt that it would be successful. I think he just didn't realize how successful it would be.
Well, at some point early in 1937, somebody comes into the animators' room and says, basically turned up the heat on them because these animators were so invested in their characters and their scenes, they weren't turning it over to other animators to get it ready for print. I found that really interesting. It was that these animators were so invested in these characters.
That's right. They were so they felt so proprietary about their characters that that they didn't trust anybody that was farther down the the chain of production, and they were actually creating a bottleneck in production because they were insisting on doing everything themselves.
Yeah, but eventually it was ready for Christmas time in 1937, and it was a big hit. But even though it was a big hit, within a year or so, Disney was back in trouble because Pinocchio, the next animated film, didn't make as much money, although, you know, it was a successful film, but he had really spent a lot of money on it. And he comes up with another Disney idea, which is the idea of recycling these films from time to time.
Yeah, that's and I found that a pretty interesting thing, too, because I grew up in a world where you just expected the films to keep showing up again in theaters on a regular basis.
It makes sense because there's always a new generation of children who haven't seen it.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the time, it was considered a gamble too, because there was this. It seems funny to me that there would be, you know, since I basically live in the 1920s and 30s, it seems funny to me that people would have a phobia about a film being an old movie. But in fact, there was some real concern that it might not be a good idea. But in fact, the first major reissue in 1944 turned out to be every bit as big a hit as the first time Snow White was released. So it went out and became a hit all over again, and that led to the practice of doing the same thing with all of their animated features. They would release them on a regular rotation so that every 7 years or so, a new generation would see them in theaters. And that continued up until the time when they started putting them on video.
Now, you mentioned the connection between the animator who did the deer and Snow White and Bambi. Were there other direct connections from this film in which, you know, something that an animator did became the basis for another film?
Well, there were always connections, yeah. I think that you can, because that's just the way that Walt Disney was. When he accomplished something, a lot of people would have been content to sit back and feel good about that. But his tendency was to take that and use it as the foundation for something else. So, for example, the multiplane camera was one of the devices that was developed right around the time of Snow White, and it was this camera crane that was almost two stories tall, where you could shoot down through widely separated planes of artwork and create this illusion of depth, which again helped to build up the convincing feeling of fantasy in the film. And people love the multiplane now. It's a really intriguing thing. And in fact, we've got one of them. We've got one of the original multiplane cranes on display at the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco. Hmm. But where most people probably would have just felt good about that and said, okay, great, we've got this great thing. Now we can just use this. Walt's tendency was to say, now what can we do that's even more elaborate than that? And they wound up coming up with even more elaborate effects for Pinocchio and Fantasia that were so involved and so intricate that they couldn't even do them on the multiplane crane, so they had to find other ways to do those.
JB, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Rich. It's been great talking with you about this.
Film historian J.B. Kaufman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled The Fairest One of All, The Making of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.